Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, which returns after a four-month break to focus on the upcoming United Nations talks in December in Copenhagen. I don't think it's an overstatement to say that these talks are the most important that mankind has ever convened, as nearly 200 national governments try to arrive at a global deal which will enable us to avoid dangerous and catastrophic levels of climate destabilisation. We're going to start in earnest next week, but this week we are very pleased to bring you a recording of an event organised last autumn to launch the Public Interest Research Centre's Climate Safety Report. Climate Safety summarised how some of the most recent science, especially observations of the rate of Arctic sea ice melt, was showing us that we needed to act more radically and more urgently than we previously thought. In a moment, we're going to be hearing from award-winning author and journalist George Monbiot, Jeremy Leggett, director of the solar energy company Solar Century, Green Party leader Caroline Lucas, MEP, and activist Leila Dean, on what they think our response should be to this new framing of the problem. We're going to skip the evening's first two presentations, which focus on the science, as we'll be looking at this in some depth next week. In summary, though, Tyndall Centre Research Director Kevin Anderson showed that if we waited until 2020 for global emissions to stop rising and start falling, then we'd need to reduce emissions by an unprecedented 10% per year in order to give us just a 50% chance of staying within the 2 degrees centigrade limit, which the EU is currently defining as the threshold between acceptable and dangerous climate change. A threshold which many now think has been set too high. These kind of reductions in greenhouse gas emissions are unprecedented, and the event most closely associated with such reductions in our history is the economic collapse of the Soviet Union in the 1990s. This leads Anderson to conclude that we need a planned economic contraction and that we need to start adapting to a world with average global temperatures 4 degrees higher than they were before the Industrial Revolution. A truly frightening prospect. Next week we'll be comparing Kevin Anderson's findings to two papers published in last week's issue of Nature, which outline the emissions budget we would need to keep within to give us a 75% chance of staying within the 2 degrees centigrade limit. A key finding is that the earlier global emissions peak and start to fall, the easier it is to keep within our budget, which is why the following presentation from George Monbiot is so important.
Well, there are two rational responses to what we've been hearing from Kevin and from Tim. The first is to rip off all our clothes, paint ourselves blue, and run screaming down the street, which is an entirely reasonable way of dealing with what we just heard. The second is to demand from government a crash program of carbon descent of the kind that I'm about to spell out. This isn't definitive, and we welcome further ideas. But here's a way in which we could reduce carbon emissions in the UK by 25% by the end of 2012, which is the sort of scale that we're talking about. And all this can be done with very few changes to existing infrastructure, other than those planned or in the pipeline already, and simply through the exercise of political will. Generally, they are self-financing. We start off by saying the government must immediately, as a national and international priority, renegotiate the European Emissions Trading Scheme. From this year, the cap must be brought down to at least 10%, if not 20%, below what it is today. The entire scheme should be based on auctioning rather than giving emissions rights away to polluting companies. The money raised from that auction is then used for the following purposes. Number one, as part of a new Green Deal, training up a new army of green builders, people who know how to build new houses but also how to retrofit existing houses, insulators, plasterers, renderers, decorators. And following that, and following that very quickly, because that takes merely a few months, we have a rollout of a massive subsidy program for insulating your home and replacing the windows. Basically, everyone who wants to apply, they will get a 100% subsidy for insulation and window replacement. They will have a stick as well as a carrot because they will know that the cap on the ETS will come down so fast and therefore gas prices will rise so fast that within 10 years, if they haven't done this, if they haven't insulated their homes, they will be paying a fortune to heat them. We need a program so fast that it doubles the speed of the German program and 10% of the homes in the UK every year are fully insulated and the windows replaced if necessary. All landlords will have an obligation within 10 years to have their homes fully insulated or they cannot rent them out anymore. At the same time, we need a radical program to replace appliances throughout those homes. That means that the incandescent light bulb must be banned by April 2009. By July 2009, no fridge or freezer will be on sale, which is less than an A+, and no other appliance can be on sale, which is less than a B. And then those categories get phased out into A++ and A over the course of the next 2 years. So an acceleration of a program that's already taking place, but a massive acceleration. We need to see the government publishing a timetable for the complete replacement of all thermal power generating plant and its replacement with low carbon sources, except for the generating plant required for emergency backup. And we need to see, and this is a more controversial part, a tough consents regime to push through some of the necessary wind farms and other developments such as the Severn Barrage, so that we can start unblocking this very choked up pipeline of renewable energy schemes. At the same time, we need a radical overhaul of transport using as much as possible existing infrastructure. The first thing you do is to create an enormous differential between the least polluting and the most polluting cars in terms of vehicle excise duty. I suggest that the differential is £3,000 a year. You then use that money to radically re-engineer the streets for public transport and for cycling, particularly using the programme spelt out in Lynn Sloman's excellent book, Carsick. You go on to push forward the coach program, which was devised by Alan Storkey, the Cambridge economist, whereby he shows how using existing motorway space but dedicating lanes exclusively for coaches, we can radically cut carbon emissions without actually changing journey times or general convenience. We need to rescind the biofuels obligation immediately. We need to cap the number of landing slots at airports and stop the airport expansion program and put ourselves on a trajectory so that by 2030, the maximum number of flights permitted in the United Kingdom is 5% of current levels. We then go on to look at issues such as agriculture. And a staggering thing which came out of the PERC report, one extraordinary fact which took me by surprise, is the remarkable contribution to the UK's carbon emissions from the burning of moors for grouse shooting. Well, I think, ladies and gentlemen, this is something we can do without. We need to see at the same time all agricultural subsidies begin to be devoted towards the most effective carbon-saving schemes, which boost levels of soil carbon. But there is no point whatsoever in limiting the demand for fossil fuels unless simultaneously you are limiting the supply. Because if fossil fuels are extracted from the ground, they will be burnt. That is the only purpose of extracting them. So we need to see all current permissions for open cast coal mining rescinded. We need to see all government support, tax breaks, favourable tax regimes, other forms of support for oil and gas removed, and a crash programme for cutting and eventually closing completely the oil and gas exploitation operations in the United Kingdom. And all this is to start between now and 2012. I've mentioned only the things which can be done in that short timescale. But those things, and there are many more which could be mentioned, could by themselves bring about a 25% cut without bringing the economy crashing down. In fact, through the new Green Deal elements, they could, in fact, boost employment in exactly the sectors which we want to target. Can we do it? Yes, we can. Will it be enough? Well, God only knows. but it's the only option we've got. Well, not the only option. Has anyone got any blue paint?
I want to offer my thoughts about actions and positivity in the context of a slight widening of the context in which we're dealing with the climate crunch, if you like. There is, in a sense, three crunches facing us at the moment. The first and most immediate one in terms of the headlines is, of course, the credit crunch. And this has washed over the world to the surprise of almost everybody, and indeed everybody in the financial services sector. And it is changing the world in a way that, you know, most of us just haven't seen in our lifetimes. And I think this is something that we have to work with as we deal with the climate crunch. You know, we will have opportunities in this collective effort to re-engineer capitalism, for that is what it comes down to. And then we have another thing as well that's just around the corner. More and more people are warning of a massive energy crunch within a few years, including the IEA, which is the body set up by governments essentially to promote fossil fuels. They're now warning, as you may know, that within 5 years, well, there's a very high risk, as they put it, of oil production in the world dropping dramatically. So high as energy prices are now, they're going to go even higher. There'll be a third great global energy crisis, and for many countries, that will be experienced almost as an energy famine, as producing countries keep oil and gas back to fuel their own massive infrastructure programs funded by these hundreds of billions of dollars of oil money and gas money that's been going into OPEC and Russia. So if that analysis is correct, and growing numbers of people believe it is, my company was involved with seven others in an industry task force that looked at this for the whole of the last year. And we just produced a report a few weeks ago that you can get from the website peakoiltaskforce.org, all one word, Peak Oil Task Force, that talks about this. So we will be forced, whereas with climate we've sort of ifed and butted and, you know, collectively not managed to get our act together, with this peak oil threat, we will be forced to really accelerate the very technologies that we know we need to survive the climate crunch. And let me give you just one example of how realistic this is. Let me take something that George said and put a bit of color on it. The idea of a carbon army of new workers to deal with climate change. That is exactly the kind of mobilization that governments are going to have to bring in just to deal with the credit crunch. You can already see it in the rhetoric of President-elect Obama, and indeed even dear old Alistair Darling. They're going to have to mobilize jobs. Let's just look at one example of how that can work. British Gas had a little experiment. They took eight streets and they gave people rudimentary instruction on the types of energy efficiency that George talked about. And bingo, with minimal interventions, the people in those houses cut their energy bills by 30% almost overnight and their emissions by 20% in those eight streets. Now, suppose we did it nationwide. What would we need? And the IPPR has worked out exactly that. We'd need a little carbon army, a carbon regiment, if you like, of 10,000 trained advisors to go around street by street. What would that cost us? £500 million. Oh, my God. £500 million. Sounds like a lot of money, doesn't it? You know what they'd save in the first year of doing that? £4.3 billion. Half gives you 4.3, just in two measures, loft insulation and cavity walls. That's just the beginning of the long list that George gave us some of, and there's more to come there. One other quick thought that's optimistic: energy efficiency can't do everything. You have to generate energy. We have to generate it in new ways, electricity and heating. Right now in Silicon Valley, all those bright young things that gave you the Silicon Revolution are giving you the clean tech revolution. And billions in investment is flowing into that right now, including from many of our pension funds. The figures, $1.3 trillion is what the world invests in energy of all kinds, hardly any of it in nuclear, every year. And what's going into renewables, almost $150 billion right now. So it's accelerating very fast. We're working with the grain already people who care only about money, who care nothing for the types of things that have brought all of us here tonight, are already getting motivated to plough disproportionate sums of money into this massive family of survival generation technologies, 50 families of technologies they recognize as being really exciting, these investors in Silicon Valley. So we have that to work with too. And you might say, well, how can we work with the financial institutions? Answer, your pensions. Anything to do with your pensions. Your pension fund trustees, if you're teachers, you know, the teaching union, pension fund trustees, we must lean on the Mississippi River of capital that's going into these suicidal technologies and flip it to where it needs to go. And it will need to go there because of the re-engineering of capitalism that will come out of the credit crunch. And you know what? It already is going there in accelerating rates simply because of the responses of investors to the manifest attractions of these clean technologies, whether you believe in climate change or not.
I have to say that this week has been itself an object lesson, really, in seeing at first hand the logjam which is paralysing serious action on climate change. It started on Monday with the pre-budget report. I mean, I really fail to see how a crisis caused by debt and overconsumption can possibly be solved by more debt and more consumption. As others have said, that could have been an opportunity to invest in renewable energies and energy efficiency, to introduce this Green New Deal, to have a massive investment into hundreds of thousands of green jobs, and it was squandered. It could have been an opportunity to move away from ever-increasing economic growth as the overriding objective of public policy and to have started the shift towards the much-needed steady-state economy, and it was missed. So that was Monday. On Tuesday, as a member of the European Parliament's Environment Committee, I was in intense negotiations with the French presidency on the EU's energy and climate package, desperately trying to stop the Council of Ministers from massively diluting the original Commission proposals, insufficiently ambitious as they already were, which was essentially for a 20% cut in emissions by 2020, moving automatically, so-called, to 30% if there's an international agreement. Now, George was just talking about the emissions trading system, and that's the bit that I'm following for the Environment Committee. The Environment Committee is actually a co-legislator on this, so it was fascinating and enormously depressing to be in those debates with the French presidency and to see how so many issues, just ring-fencing any of those revenues that will come from the auctioning of emission permits, ring-fencing any of them for developing countries, was off the table. That this automaticity of moving from the 20% to the 30% reduction target if there's an international agreement, that is now back up for negotiation. Masses of the work is going to be done overseas, not actually making reductions here in the UK or EU. It's going to be outsourced elsewhere. And sitting there is the most frustrating thing in the world, because you want to scream at them and say to them, don't you realise the seriousness of what's at stake? How can you be diluting the ambition of the proposals on the table? That was Tuesday. Wednesday was a better night. I went to an early showing of The Age of Stupid, this amazing film, which features Pete Postlethwaite in around 2055 in a climate-devastated world, looking back at life now, today, in 2008, wondering why we didn't act to save ourselves while we had the chance. And that really is the question. Why aren't politicians acting? Because as we know, climate change isn't primarily a technical challenge. We know more or less the kinds of things we need to do. It's not primarily a scientific challenge. We know more or less the kinds of evidence that's coming through. And it's not even primarily an economic challenge, because we've seen how billions of dollars can be mobilized when it's needed. It is, as others have said, primarily a challenge of political will. How do we stop ourselves going down in history as the species that spent all its time talking about its own extinction rather than taking active steps to avoid it? How do we address this monumental failure of imagination to try to imagine what the implications of inaction will be? And how do we address this equally monumental failure of political will? Well, three quick thoughts. First, to reframe the climate crisis as a security problem, that we need to mobilize resources on the same scale that governments bring to more traditional security threats like the so-called war on terror. If we can mobilize it for an illegal and immoral war in Iraq, we ought to be able to mobilize it for climate change. Secondly, Secondly, challenging the holy grail of endless economic growth. That is what gives the corporations such power over the politicians. I see them in Brussels. Brussels is full of corporate lobbyists, all of them warning that to introduce more ambitious legislation would harm the G word, growth. All of them trying to dilute the targets, delay the timetables, diminish the ambition. And so this current turbo-capitalist system is diametrically opposed to the steady-state economy that we urgently need to see. You're going to put me out of time if you keep doing that. Stop clapping. Add it onto my time. It's not fair. And the third thing was about reframing the debate. This is what we were just talking about a few moments ago, the idea that we need to get away, I think, from talking about giving things up, about shivering around a candle in a cave. We need to get better at painting a compelling green vision of what a zero-carbon world could be like. Because in so many ways, it could be such an inspiring world. You know, the kind of world we have today, in the richer world at least, isn't making us happy anyway, as Kevin said. And you know, and what's so difficult about living in streets where there are kids playing again? What's so difficult about having properly insulated homes? What's so difficult about spending less time working, more time with your family? What's so difficult about lying on your deathbed not thinking, I wish I'd spent more time in the office, you know? I mean, this is not such a sacrifice, so we should be changing that. And then finally, a conclusion, two more final recommendations. The first a little controversial, but if we want green policies, I have to say one of the ways to get them is to vote for green politicians. So let's change our politicians. Secondly, I agree with George, we need a massive campaign of civil disobedience. Because I don't know about you, but I'm getting tired. I am getting tired of meetings, even good ones like this, and demonstrations, even though we've all got to be there on the 6th of December, and letters, even though we still have to write them, and the inquiries. But we simply don't have time just for that. Politicians, most of them, are inherently cautious. The wider movement has to give them political cover for taking much more ambitious decisions. That means we have to make it more difficult for them not to take action than to take action. And one of the most inspiring events that I've taken part in this year was the climate rush last month, when women gathered at exactly the same time and place in Parliament that the suffragettes did 100 years ago. 100 years ago, the suffragettes rushed on Parliament to demand the vote. We rushed on Parliament to demand nothing less than the right to life itself, because we shouldn't forget that because of the inaction of our spineless politicians, people are dying now, today, tonight, from the droughts and the famines and the conflicts that are driven by climate change. So 100 years ago, Emmeline Pankhurst said that to be a militant was a privilege. Well, I think she was right, and that we need to take that same approach.
Basically, I read this report and I was really depressed. And if anybody, and quite a few of you do, know me in this room, that's quite hard, because I tend to try and be naively optimistic about climate change. The fact is that the realities aren't yet realities, they are still potential realities, and the fact that we can still affect change on them is the only thing that stops me buying a boat and running away. Well, that and the fact I can't afford a boat. But I think the most depressing thing about, like, climate change generally is the idea of these tipping points, that there are these points that we have to stop before we can get there, and otherwise it's irreversible and it's too late. And I spent the whole of today thinking about tipping points and climate science and the potential solutions. And actually, I've spent so much time in the last 2 years just on the streets or in a field or trying to talk to people about climate change that I've kind of run out of new ideas on that front. I think we know the science, I think we know the solutions, I think we know the actions that need to happen as well. But the theory of tipping points gave me inspiration, because we also have our own tipping points, and we can see a lot of those tipping points in front of us now. Anyone that's been involved in the direct action movement in the last 2 years will say that 2 years ago we never thought we would be here. In the last 2 years, we've not only put aviation and airport expansion not just on the map, but at risk of not happening at all. And we've also put the idea of new coal not only on the map, but the risk of being cancelled. Both at King's North and at Heathrow, there are contested site battles that will not pass easily. And that is what inspires me, that's what continues to inspire me, that we can get something to happen. Now, I know that if we stop airport expansion and we stop new coal-fired power stations, that doesn't mean that we stop climate change, because there's all these other things to do that are much more complicated and much harder to run campaigns on. But what either of those wins would mean is a sense that what we're doing is important. And that would be a tipping point. reaching a tipping point on either Heathrow or King's North would give us the strength to carry on the other one and to start new battles and to support other people in the rest of the world starting those battles. And so I think we can't underestimate the importance of just getting that one win in order to tip us from where we are, which is a sense of, you know, slightly helpless optimism, to a sense that we're really going to get some change here. So either of those would be great tipping points. But there's two other really good tipping points that I've spotted coming up in 2009. One is an ideological tipping point, and Caroline and George have already mentioned it previously, but to come back, the idea that our economic system has failed us is something that some people knew was going to happen a long time ago, and it is something that we've been saying for quite a while, and it is a moment when, despite what the government does, despite the continuing business as usual, the world sees that the emperor has no clothes, and the world sees that we have to put something before economic growth, which is what we've been saying for quite a long time. So that too is a tipping point in the sense that if we are out there and we are pushing this issue and we are refusing to go back to business as usual, then we can get change. And getting any kind of change to the idea of promoting economic growth above and beyond everything else will be a massive tipping point for this movement, because it would be the end of neoliberalism for a start, and that would be fantastic. Last but not least, we have a global tipping point. And by that, I'm not going to say that in 2009, the international talks that will happen at Copenhagen will be mind-blowing and that suddenly all the politicians will turn around and apologise for everything they've done in the last 100 years and say, actually, you know, let's just make massive cuts. But we can say that. We can use Copenhagen 2009 as a moment to bring the world together on climate change. And I have a very positive sense that in Europe and across the world, Copenhagen, because it is the point at which we have to get another deal, a post-Kyoto deal, and partly because that deal will be so disappointing, it will be a moment to kickstart the public to taking action on climate change. So that's another tipping point that we have to watch, and it's something we have to make the most of.
In reverse order, you've been listening to Leila Dean, Caroline Lucas MEP, Jeremy Leggett and George Monbiot speaking at the launch of the Climate Safety Report on 27th of November last year at the Friends Meeting House in Euston, London. Many thanks to filmmaker Beth Stratford for the use of her sound recordings and to the Public Interest Research Centre for organising the event. The Climate Safety Report can be downloaded from climatesafety.org. Do join us again over the coming weeks as we try to make sure that the signal from the scientific community is being heard by the policymakers that are putting together the global deal. And with the European elections coming up in about a month's time, you might want to revisit our assessment of the various UK political parties' positions on climate change, which can be found at the Climate Radio Archive at www.climateradio.org. Thanks for listening.